From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nambi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome back to the studio.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Louis Farabee. He is the chancellor of D.C. Public Schools, and we know you have a lot of questions and comments for him. But first, we wanted to take a look at politics in Virginia. So we invited Quentin Kidd, the academic director of the Wasson Center for Civic Leadership at Christopher Newport University, to join us. Quentin Kidd, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, as always.
Tom Sherwood, before we get to Virginia, this past Wednesday morning, early in the morning, there was a car stopped on New York Avenue Northeast, and police were called to the scene by somebody who said someone appeared to be sleeping in his car. When they got there, they saw a man sitting in the car with his handgun in his waistband. He was apparently asleep. They were able to awaken him, but apparently when he awakened, the car moved forward, stopped, and then moved forward again. And then of the fairly large number of police officers who were there, one police officer shot into the vehicle 10 times, and apparently as a result, the individual dies. Now, the D.C. police chief has released some footage of this, but it is still a mystery as to why this police officer shot and why only he shot.
Yes, there are still questions. It's important to note that under the city's law, the mayor has the authority to release crime footage if she believes it's in the public interest. And while council members called on her to do so, she decided that she would. So there was a fairly quick turnaround of the video on this. I don't understand. You've just described pretty well what happened. But I know enough about covering police in 50 years, and I've been to the police training academy. I've seen them work. I don't understand one thing about this shooting before the shooting. If you come upon a car where someone is sleeping or in the roadway and the person you see has a gun, why would you not, as a standard routine matter, put a police car in front of the car? So that when the person awakes or comes to his senses or just looks up, there will be a police car in front of him or her, whoever it might be. So they cannot either drive away and they will know that the police are there. So I just don't understand that. But that's not a side issue, but it's one issue in this shooting. We do not want the police officers to shoot. I think the chief said 10 shots were fired. And because of the police shield that this one officer, a 14-year veteran, was holding in front of him, you can only see through a sliver of the shield what was going on. And so not everyone, there has to be an investigation. Chairman Mendelson of the council called on a thorough, fast, complete investigation. The officer has not given a formal statement as of last night. Exactly what he saw that no one else saw that had him shoot. The chief said it's against policy to shoot at a fleeing car anyway unless there's imminent harm or danger expected. So it seems the policies were violated. It seems the policies were violated. And we do need more information. Whoever this guy was, good guy, bad guy, innocent guy, the issue is, as you just asked, why did that police officer
But as
shoot?
With everything else in the District of Columbia, there is a racial undercurrent. Ward 4 council member Janice Louise George tweeted, sitting here trying to figure out how law enforcement can successfully de-escalate a white domestic terrorist in a truck threatening to blow up the Capitol. That was the incident that happened when the police had an hours-long negotiation with a white man parked in front of the Library of Congress who told police he had exclusives. She wanted to know what the difference was between how police could de-escalate that without violence, but not a black man who fell asleep in his car.
Yeah. And the person on the Hill, of course, was threatening with a bomb. But again, they surrounded this person. They negotiated with him. But I don't understand. You look at the video, you'll see five or six officers standing around the car, close to the car, but no vehicle is blocking. It is an ABC thing to do. You just block in the person you think might flee. Please, Chief, get us the information.
Tom Sherwood gives us the information based on his many years following fire trucks and police cars around Washington as a reporter. As we said, we're talking with Quentin Kidd, the academic director of the Wasson Center for Civic Leadership at Christopher Newport University. Quentin Kidd, you, or the Wasson Center more specifically, released a survey yesterday about the upcoming Virginia elections. In the governor's race, Democratic candidate Terry McAuliffe is leading Republican Glenn Youngkin 50-41%. Tell us why the lead is so large. Which demographic groups are polling well for apparently all of the statewide Democratic candidates?
So the statewide Democratic candidates are holding strong and doing well in the places and among the demographic groups that they have for the last decade or so in statewide elections. They're doing really well in Northern Virginia, which is an increasingly larger part of the electorate in Virginia. They're doing really well among younger voters. They're doing really well among Black voters. They're doing really well among female voters. And all of that combined contributes to the lead. Both candidates, regardless of the office you're talking about, both candidates do really well among their base core party identifiers. It's just a function of how many of those party identifiers and voters there are on each side. And, you know, increasingly Virginia has a Democratic electorate that's bigger than a Republican electorate.
Tom Sherwood.
Professor Kidd, thank you for being with us. Sure. Earlier polling suggested it was closer, but this seems to be more like what happened with President Biden winning by 10 points in Virginia. Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat, up 9%. Only 6% undecided in the governor's race, the lieutenant governor's race, and the attorney general's race. I thought that was unusual. The overall picture, it seems to me, paying attention to the race, is that Glenn Youngkin has spent more time trying to solidify his conservative base. He's most popular in Southwest Virginia, where his vote should be almost a given. And he has spent too little time trying to pick off Democrat independent voters, women, in the suburbs of Northern Virginia. And I know he's had problems with his private remarks he made about abortion, and he's been very reluctant. He's been hammered by the Post on his vaccine position. But he doesn't seem, as a new candidate, maybe new to politics on the ground, retail politics, he hasn't attempted to pick off the people in Northern Virginia who always provide those large margins for the Democrats. Has he made a fundamental blunder here?
Well, I think your assessment is spot on. Republicans themselves said at the very beginning that they felt like they had an opportunity to pull back those moderate suburban voters, large numbers of them in Northern Virginia, a significant chunk of them in suburban Richmond and Hanover or in Henrico and Chesterfield County, a good chunk of them in suburban Hampton Roads. And they said initially that was their path to victory. They had to pull back that moderate suburban voter. And to your point, I think Glenn Youngkin has the same problem in some ways that Ed Gillespie had. He doesn't have arms long enough to embrace the base, which Republicans have to have in Virginia to win, and also reach over and cuddle up to the moderate middle of the electorate. Ed Gillespie tried to do the same thing, eventually just accepted that he had to embrace the base. Glenn Youngkin says he was going to try to do both, but it looks like he can't move away from the base enough to be able to satisfy the moderate voter, and that's really where he is right now, struggling.
And following that up, I certainly have been watching all of the advertisements, the daily emails, the TV, radio appearances in Northern Virginia by Terry McAuliffe, who has simply hammered the hell out of Youngkin. There's no other way to say it. And here's the reason I think it's so important that Youngkin has not pivoted to the people he needs in the middle to win. Early voting starts in 3 weeks, September 17th. This election is upon us. It's late.
Absolutely. McAuliffe started hitting Youngkin the moment Youngkin surprisingly won that Republican convention, and he hasn't stopped hitting him. I think part of the issue is Youngkin has not been able to he's been on his heels the entire time. He's not been able to get on offense. Now, a lot could change between now and Election Day, but to your point, early voting is starting. Both sides are going to try to bank as many votes as they can. So unlike, say, the race where George Allen came from behind and beat Mary Sue Terry, In that race, you know, everyone voted on Election Day. Very few people voted early. Nowadays in Virginia, large chunks of the electorate vote early, and so you really have to have yourself sort of running on overdrive as this 1st of September hits, or you're really in trouble. And so I think that's where Republicans find themselves right now. We still have a long way to go, but well, it's more and more difficult.
Can I ask? You may have answered the question that Rashan in Great Falls has. Rashan, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. That was precisely my question. We have seen polling over the years favor a candidate, and then once all the votes are counted, that candidate does not end up being victorious. So really the question was, what role will early voting, absentee voting, and getting out the vote have in determining who will win this gubernatorial race?
Quentin Kidd, you've mostly answered that question already, so your response can be brief.
Yeah, campaigns and candidates lock their votes in as early as they can. That's the role it plays anymore.
Let me ask you a very quick question. And one good news maybe for the Republicans is they have a narrow minority in the 100-member General Assembly House. All 100 seats are up. Some Republicans have said to me that their fallback position or their second position is if they can't win the statewide races, they hope to gain, I think it's either 5 or 6 seats in the General Assembly House and take control of the House so they can be a backstop against whatever the Democrats want to do should they win the statewide elections. Do you see that also?
Yeah, and they've targeted, I think, 12 races. Democrats picked up a lot of seats in 2017, and then 2019 they held those seats. Republicans want to take them away. I think another flash of potential hope for Republicans is Terry McAuliffe's only at 50%. That's a margin of error move, up or down 3 points. It could be a really close race coming into the final weeks of the election. And so, all is certainly not lost. That's what a campaign is all about.
There are 2 debates in October, I believe.
That's right.
Right. Or September or October. There are only two debates instead of 5 because Youngkin has turned them all down, which I think is another bonehead move by his campaign, but maybe he has smarter people than me.
Quentin, when Donald Trump was president, Virginia Democrats used him to campaign against Republicans. Now that we have a Democrat president, do you think the same approach could work for Virginia Republicans, especially considering what's happening in Afghanistan right now and how the Biden administration has been handling it?
Yeah, if you watch Republican surrogates and Republican candidates on social media, they are attempting to turn the narrative against Democratic statewide candidates by using Biden and the Afghanistan and the pullout in Afghanistan. We'll see if it's going to happen. I think if that's going to be effective, we'll start seeing it in the next several weeks. On the other hand, McAuliffe is trying to make Donald Trump a central part of the campaign and allegations against Youngkin, and I don't expect that to change.
Quickly about the other statewide races, what can you tell us about the race for lieutenant governor between Democrat Hala Ayala and Republican Winsome Sears?
So Democrats are leading both of those races. I think Mark Herring's lead is the biggest. We have him at 12. I think that is largely a name ID lead. You know, Herring is probably very popular among Democrats. Democrats know him. Jason Miaris is relatively new to a statewide audience, so there may be a name ID lead there. Winsome Sears is trailing Hala Ayala by 10 points. I don't think that's as much a name ID issue. Winsome Sears is more known statewide. I think it's a fundamental sort of Democratic advantage in Virginia lead that these candidates have more than anything else, with some name ID effects on the edges.
This may be a big election for Virginia politics, but it's an off year for national elections. What do you expect voter turnout to be like?
I'm guessing 40s, lower to mid 40s. That's typical. It's typically in the 40s. It's been in the upper 40s because of the level of energy, but I'm not sure it's going to be that high this year. I'm guessing 43 to 46, something like that.
Quentin Kidd, he is the academic director of the Wasson Center for Civic Leadership at Christopher Newport University in Virginia. Quentin, thank you for joining us. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Up next is Louis Furby, the chancellor of D.C. Public Schools. before we go directly to the school's chancellor, Tom Sherwood, what's going on with the Prince George's County School Board? There was an ethics report on the school board. The ethics report, however, apparently is riddled with errors, and apparently there are about four or five members of the school board who, about whom these ethical reports were very critical of, but it seems that those five members of the school board have been a thorn in the side of the political establishment in Prince George's County. And so these ethics reports were sent not only to the people to whom they were supposed to be sent, but to a lot of other political heavyweights in Prince George's County, some of whom had no idea what the source of these ethics reports were.
This is some kind of English PBS mystery series where there are too many rooms and too many doors and too many trap doors. The bad news is that in the midst of an epidemic, the county, the state's largest school system, the leaders of it, are entangled in personality and political kind of disputes where the kids are off going to school and they're hoping they'll be there safe and the parents can get them home safely. But this is a fallback. A decade ago almost, Rashern Baker, the county executive in 2013, worked out a deal where the county executive would appoint the chair of the board and the superintendent, or the CEO, they called them. And then there would be some elected members, and a hybrid board would calm things down. Well, it did for a while. Then Angela also Brooks was elected as the county executive, and she's made her own appointment to head the board. And that board member has battled with some of the elected members. I'm superficially going through this just to say.
Yeah, because it's very deep and complicated.
The issue is to me, as much respect as I have for Angela also Brooks, she has not stepped forward to call these people into a room and knock a few heads together. This is the school system at a critical moment, and it's unraveling. I don't understand it. The anonymous mailings of this ethics report, the flawed ethics report that has its own ethics issues. I do believe if the Angela also Brooks, who has declared she's running for a second term, she needs to use that strong hand that I know she has to get people into a room and say, what the hell?
As we mentioned, Lewis Ferebee is joining us. He's the chancellor of D.C. Public Schools. Lewis Ferebee, thank you so much for joining us.
Good afternoon, Kojo. Thank you for having me.
Class starts on Monday for D.C. Public School students, and the vast majority of students are required to be in-person. Students with a doctor-approved medical exemption can do virtual learning. But Chancellor Ferebee, why is DCPS requiring in-person learning?
Well, as the speaker said before me, I couldn't have said it better. This is a critical time, and it's time to get our students back into school. It's been too much time away, and many of our students have been learning remotely over the past 18 months plus. And so we know the best place for our students to learn is in the classroom. We've been preparing for this for a very long time, and we've done it before. We've done it in a smaller scale over the summer, and then we also did it last school year. And we're excited to have our students back on campus come Monday.
Well, the Delta variant is still on the rise. Students under 12 still have not been vaccinated. Prince George's County Public Schools is offering an online option for K through 6th grade students, while a vaccine is not available to that group. Montgomery County allowing virtual learning if students or family members have health concerns. Arlington County allowing families to opt in to virtual learning. Why did DC Public Schools not include a remote learning option for students under 12 or to those living with someone with a health condition?
Yeah, to be clear, Kojo, we have a medical exemption policy for remote learning. So there's a form that families need to take to a licensed physician. Licensed physician completes the form, describes why the student, due to medical reasons, would not be served well in an in-person environment and why that student needs to learn remotely. We review those forms, and once we confirm the documentation, the student is approved for virtual learning.
But that only applies to students, right?
It only applies to students.
What if there are family members? Does it count?
Well, of course, we will want those family members to be vaccinated. We firmly believe that that is the most important thing all of us can do that are age appropriate for the vaccine at this time.
Chancellor, you have a difficult job. This is Tom Sherwood. Thank you for being with us. You have a difficult job. The thing I've heard about the exemption for a student who has immunocompromised issues is that he or she may have a brother or a sister or another family member in schools, and they are being required to go to school where they may encounter the virus and bring it home to the immunocompromised. So that's an issue I have heard, but I would like to go to one kind of it's not superficial issue, but easy issue. And this is the lunch. You want kids in school. Parents I've talked to are praising the teachers and the staff for preparing all around the city. I've heard it from parents who are involved in their schools. And they all agree that it's better to have the kids in school than at home for another year of learning at home. But one thing I heard from one parent who's concerned, she says in her school, 75 parents have volunteered to be lunchroom monitors so the kids can eat outside, so the teachers can take a break and the parents can keep the kids crowd outside eating lunch safely rather than being inside with their mask off, eating, drinking, and talking. But many schools, parents are not available to do that. What is the issue about lunch? In Montgomery County, Tom Hucker, the president of the council there, said this is called the lunch loophole, that you keep kids separated in the classrooms all day, but then they go into the lunchroom. What is the policy on eating outside or eating inside? Is there a clear policy?
Yeah, thank you, Tom. I also want to just take a moment and agree and affirm the phenomenal work of our teachers. Our educators have been
great. I did it so you wouldn't take time doing it.
Okay, well, I won't spend too much time on it, but I just had to stop and say that for a moment. Yeah, so we certainly are encouraging meals to be consumed outside. And we have many schools that have the space to do that. But we also are very conscientious of the fact that we do still have outdoor activities that are occurring. So we still have recess. We still have physical education activities that are taking place outside. And then we also know that all of our outdoor facilities are not situated in the same way and structured in the same way. And so we're encouraging schools to maximize outdoor space as much as possible for learning and for lunch and meals. But this is a part of a layered approach for us in terms of mitigating any transmission of COVID in our schools, which includes we have large HEPA filters in our cafeterias, in our gymnasiums, along with other units for our classroom. We're still enforcing universal masking and social distancing. Okay. So we believe that through this layered approach, we can successfully have lunch in the cafeteria when we need to, but of course, students can eat outside, and we're supporting schools with furniture and other material that they may need for eating.
All right, let me get to my we have a lot of callers, and I want to get to my second call. I know some people are concerned the HVAC and systems that you're talking about aren't fully working, including air conditioning, but I want to move on to the larger issue. Parents are nervous. They want to send their kids to school. What is the notification policy? I know that the city auditor, Kathy Patterson, noted that one charter school had an outbreak and they did not notify the parents until 9 days later. What is the policy if a teacher, staffer, or students are infected with COVID? What is the policy to notify the parents? How quickly is that going to be done?
And we do understand that you do not have jurisdiction over charter schools.
Yeah, you don't have jurisdiction over charter schools, but just as an example, what is the public school system policy on notifying how quickly if there's an outbreak?
Yeah, so we certainly are taking our commitment to transparency and information very seriously. We have committed, as we've done last school year, informing the school community anytime that there is a positive case in the school. We also inform a classroom if there's a student that tests positive within that classroom, and we also do that if there's an adult as well. We work to do that as quickly as possible, and we're very transparent. We, of course, don't identify a student individually, but we do share with that classroom and the school-wide body of who's tested positive.
Got to take a short break, but our guest is Lewis Ferebee, Chancellor of D.C. Public Schools. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. Our guest is Louis Farabee. He's the Chancellor of D.C. Public Schools. Tom Sherwood is also with us. He's our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. You can send us a tweet at Politics Hour or email to kojo@wamu.org. Let me go directly to the phones because the first question we have from Marilyn is one we're getting from a lot of people for you, Mr. Schools Chancellor. So here's Marilyn. You're on the air, Marilyn. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much for having me, Kojo. And thank you, Chancellor Farabee, for the opportunity to respond to questions from DCPS parents. I represent a coalition of more than 100 DCPS parents who have circulated a petition that has over 1,300 signatures requesting a safer reopen plan and specifically asking for a virtual option. Now, I heard your responses earlier, but I really want to reiterate Kojo's questions around why we don't have this when the medical waiver form is really, really restrictive and does not consider immunocompromised family members. Why surrounding jurisdictions have this option and we don't when we had it in the spring, and why we don't have it now when the Delta variant is very highly transmittable and we have children under 12 who are unvaccinated and not eligible to be vaccinated. Appreciate your comments.
Let me add to that an email we got from Jose Maria. Why is DCPS not offering a remote learning option for families like Prince George's and Arlington counties using the lessons learned last year to make it even better instead of forcing all unvaccinated children under 12 to return to in-person learning and risk infection, illness, or worse? Your turn, Chancellor Farabee.
Yeah, thank you, Marilyn, for that question. I appreciate the commitment of our parents, the advocacy. We're certainly continuing to listen to our communities, and we want to continue to be responsive. So we will listen and take that under consideration. In terms of why we are where we are today, is simply this. It's aligned to CDC and DC health guidelines. It's been really clear through the science, and it's been noted, as I said earlier, by the American Association of Pediatrics, that students should be in school. And there are very unique scenarios in which they should not be in school. And we are accounting for that in our process with the medical exemption. If a student has a sibling that is immunocompromised or has another health condition that is also unique, parent or guardian should also take that student to the licensed physician that they see to get a medical exemption submitted for that student as well. But we want all of our adults, everyone in the household, as I said earlier, to ensure that they are vaccinated, as we know that is the best and strongest step we can take for every individual to have a collective response to the health emergency that we're in right now.
Meanwhile, Laura tweeted, thank you for getting our kids back into schools where they need to be. When will the mayor require vaccinations for teachers and eligible students?
Yeah, we are more focused right now on ensuring that everyone who's eligible to receive the vaccine has every opportunity to do so, which is why we have set up school sites where students can receive the COVID-19 vaccine along with other immunizations as part of their pediatric record. We also are encouraging families to take advantage of the incentives we have. So we have three middle schools that we're focused on right now where families can go, and that's Sousa, Brooklyn, and Johnson Middle School. And we also are having an event this Saturday at Banneker High School that we encourage families to join us in. I am a firm believer in the power of the vaccine, as I've been vaccinated, as my family and my son, who's also a DCPS student. And we will continue to encourage families to do so, and we will continue to explore other options if we need to. But right now, we want to get everyone aligned with our pledge, and that is to get everyone vaccinated who's eligible to ensure that we limit travel. And we're smart about taking risky behavior around our schools and also in our household.
Chancellor, is it, to be clear, are teachers required to be vaccinated by a certain time?
Yeah, teachers are required to be vaccinated.
Is it September or October?
It's in September, so they have until September 19th.
Okay.
But I also want to be really clear that in addition to our vaccine mandate for staff and the incentives and encouragement we have for the vaccine, we also are participating in a very rigorous asymptomatic testing protocol that has been established by the Office of the State Superintendent of Education.
All right, good. I apologize. Yes, I understand that you're doing that backup system to the vaccination, and that's important. I did get a message from one teacher who said that she had tried to upload her vaccination information and the portal didn't work. That could be a user error. That could be a problem. I just mentioned it to you. I also heard from a math teacher who teaches fourth and fifth grade math, who among the complaints he had is that he has not received his math books. And he said that he had been told that it would be 2 or 3 weeks. Now, as you know, this system had a horrible problem, and then the law was passed, the council passed a law many years ago. Books must be on time. I know there are delivery issues because of COVID transports, but is there an issue with textbooks and other supplies not being in the schools?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any issues with textbooks and supplies. And in fact, we have invested heavily in the use of technology as a resource for materials, and we have a 1-to-1 student device ratio for grades 3 through 12.
I don't know
12.
What a 1-to-1 student device ratio is.
That
but
means
you
every
say
student in grades 3 through 12 will get a device, okay. And that device also has digital textbooks as well. So I would just want to learn more about the
school. It was fourth and fifth grade math. I'll ask them if there's more information about supplies not being around to come to me.
Got a new release from the Mirror. Muriel Bowers and the Office of the State Superintendent of Education, OSSE, announced that all D.C. public school students and students at public charter schools participating in the district's testing program will be automatically eligible for symptomatic and random asymptomatic testing as part of the centralized school-based COVID-19 testing program with Shield T3. Apparently, that will be effective on Monday, where consent for student COVID-19 testing will take place. I was about to ask what the process will be for coronavirus testing in school for students and staff, but apparently the mayor is attempting to clarify that at this point. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, definitely. So exciting news that you just announced. We are strengthening our asymptomatic testing protocols to make it easier for families. Also want to call out that it is a very non-invasive process. So we're now using a saliva-based test, which allows families to, again, get results back quickly. And through this process, families only need to indicate to us when they are not wanting their students to be tested. So it will be an opt-out process. But we're excited that we have this new non-invasive tool, and the saliva-based test is really easy for students and staff to follow.
Well, it wasn't easy for me. You got to get enough saliva so that it's available.
Just drool a little bit. That's all.
I don't like drooling, but go ahead, Tom. You know, sure.
Drink a little or do something. All right, two quick questions. One, we've talked about the teachers and the school staffs. What about downtown, as it's referred to, the central school administration? What is the vaccination rate of the people? For example, I presume you're in your office and you maybe eat lunch in your office. I'm not sure. I was going to ask you that question too. But what about central management of the school system? How is it doing in terms of percentage vaccinated?
Yeah, so our vaccination deadline for staff is to produce documentation by September the 19th. And we're actively, encouraging everyone to report their status with us, and we have over half of our organization that has reported their vaccination status to us. And of the people who reported that to us, over 90% of those individuals are vaccinated.
Excellent.
So again, we're asking everyone to be vaccinated by September 19th. If they do not produce documentation of a vaccination card or other materials associated with their vaccine, they will be required to participate in a weekly test.
One more quick question. This is a multiple region. People live in Virginia or Maryland or whatever. School systems cross borders at different times. Do you just as a matter of fact meet with other regional superintendents like your own Council of Governments, where do you actually talk about what's happening in your jurisdiction so that you can be all on the same page? Or is that you've got enough to do, you don't have time for that?
No, definitely. I have regular conversation. There was a rich discussion on Prince George County. I have conversations with the superintendent there, superintendents in Virginia and Maryland, even in Baltimore regularly. And then there's a national cohort that I'm a part of that we also discuss some of our learnings from where we are and how we're navigating through the health emergency.
Okay. Can you explain the quarantine process for students, teachers, and school staff?
Yeah, certainly. So if any time a staff member tests positive or if there are a close contact, there's the contact tracing protocol that we follow. And if there's a need for a student staff member to quarantine, we ensure that that's followed. And then when anyone travels, they're also expected to follow the DC Health travel guidelines. If a teacher is quarantining, the teacher is well, they can teach remotely. During that time period, they're required to quarantine. And then if a student is required to quarantine, that student will have access either to live instruction with the teacher or they will receive asynchronous materials and will have contact with their educator via our online learning platforms.
What is the process if a student is showing symptoms in class? Who will assess their symptoms?
Yeah, so we have a contract with a team of health professionals that are on our campuses who monitor our health isolation room and also support us with symptom checking. And we have a rich list of items that we look for that's very detailed in terms of symptoms related to COVID. And then we also have the capability of administering symptomatic testing, and that will begin daily in our schools day one. And that is a rapid test that is done on site once the family member or adult consents to it.
Right. Well, in terms of assessing those students' health, what is Amber sent us an email. Amber asks, what is the status of school nurses and mental health providers in the schools? Will they be in person available for all students? And we'd like to add our own question. How many school nurses are working in DCPS schools this year? And what are their roles when it comes to COVID-related care? Are they helping to provide testing, screening, and quarantining for students?
So there's a school nurse assigned to every school, and yes, they will be working in person. We also have social workers, counselors, other mental health providers that will also be working in person. Then we have a partnership with Department of Behavioral Health where we have contract support as well. All of those individuals will be working in person. Our school nurses will be responsible for managing and supporting our school health suites. They will also escort students to the isolation room if there's a need for a student to be in the isolation room. And then they also monitor and track our immunization records for students to ensure that they have a clear record by their 20th day of school.
Because we've been hearing rumblings that school nurses that were contracted through Children's National cannot provide any COVID-related care. Can you clarify that for us, please?
Yeah, so as it stands right now, we have a team of contracted health professionals that are responsible primarily for COVID-related duties. And then all of our school nurses contracted through Children's Health are responsible for supporting our school health suites as they've done in the past.
Chancellor, I know this feels like a lot of incoming, but again, I want to repeat, you know, we are aware that many teachers and staff are doing their best to get schools open. I got a message from someone who says, how can the chancellor say he's not aware of supply issues when, quote, all of Cluster 5, and I don't know what Cluster 5 is, when all of Cluster 5 does not have its math books? No grades have math books. What is Cluster 5?
Yeah, so our schools are organized into clusters that are led by their superintendents for each cluster. So we have a superintendent for Cluster 1,
Cluster 5, is that some specific grade level?
Cluster 5 includes a slate of our elementary schools.
Okay,
and
well, there you have
and
it.
And again, like I mentioned earlier, our materials this year are either hard copy materials or they're digital.
Okay.
So if there isn't a hard copy of a text, I'm certain that there will be materials available that are digital.
That won't help many people who don't have digital. But let me ask you, in Montgomery County, there was a teacher who was placed on administrative leave because she declined to wear a mask. The Washington Teachers Union has been very supportive of your efforts to get the schools back open. But if a teacher is found to be not wearing a mask, what is the discipline for that? Or doing any other anti-COVID things?
On the textbooks, is that when I say that students have access to technology, is that students will have their own device when they get to school. So not having technology won't be
okay. So the books may not be there, but they'll have some digital access. What about the discipline for teachers who are found not to wear masks or do other things that are bad for the COVID infections?
Yeah, so we have a number of ways in which we address that. So there can be anonymous reporting of any time there's a visual or some sense that someone's not following our health and safety protocol. We investigate any allegations, and we also are providing progressive discipline to anyone who is not following our protocols. But honestly, that has not been an issue. We have a lot of staff members who have bought into ensuring that they are in compliance with our standards. But whenever there's a report someone is not, we always respond and follow up. And it's also embedded in our situation room that we've established with the Washington Teacher Union, which we will resume when school starts this school year.
And if, as Tom mentioned, somebody simply refuses to wear a mask or follow some other protocol, what would be the consequence for that individual?
Yeah, there'll be discipline. And,
what
you know,
discipline
again,
that
we have a
suspended and up to dismissal, depending on how severe their behavior is, beginning maybe with suspension.
There's a progressive discipline model that we follow. Of course, it would depend on aggravating or mitigating circumstances. But the reality of it is, if someone is not following the protocol, they will be removed.
Okay.
And they will be disciplined accordingly.
According to some DCPS teachers, they're being told that they will need to take unpaid COVID leave if they need to quarantine or if they have kids at home that need to quarantine. Is that the DCPS policy? And if so, why?
Yeah, so we will continue to provide accommodations for teachers for leave in alignment with our local and federal guidelines and laws. If a teacher needs to take leave that's COVID-related, all of our WTU members who are well enough to continue to work and they're required to quarantine can pivot to a remote instruction model in alignment with our MOA so they can still teach. We would want them to teach. That is the most ideal scenario. But again, that is if they're well enough to do so. We've also provided an overview of all the options through our mandatory return to work guideline and handbook. And we have a FAQ available as well to help staff answer any questions they may have about leave.
Chancellor, as a
why would the leave be unpaid, though?
Yeah, so it's like any other, you know, medical leave. If you're unable to fulfill your duties and responsibilities
like
in alignment with laws, we respond accordingly.
As a matter of probability, to be clear about this, and I think the mayor has said something like this, no matter what you do, no matter how many stones you overturn in getting ready for the schools, there are going to be instances of infections among children and staff and teachers. Do you have any sense of, you know, I think there's one school in Virginia that had like 600 students were in quarantine. It's Floyd County. Do you have any sense that there, how, what kinds of outbreaks you expect to have? Do you have some guidance that you can expect a few here and there, several, dozens, a couple of schools maybe have to close? What is your expectation going forward? No matter what you've done to prepare, you're going to have something happen.
Yeah, I don't want to predict, you know, what you know, positive cases will look like. What I can say is that, you know, our cases in schools often reflect the trends in our community. So if there's greater cases of COVID in our community, then there's typically greater cases in our schools. What we can do, however, is ensure that we all get aligned on this Stronger Together pledge. And that is, we get serious about masking, we get serious about getting vaccinated, and we limit our travel. Those three things alone are really important to ensuring that we continue operations in school.
Let me.
In terms of schools, we have a layered strategy, as I mentioned earlier,
okay,
where we have a number of different protocols to help us minimize spread. But I can tell you, based on last year and over the summer, when we did have positive cases, it was rarely related to interactions in schools. It was what people were doing outside of school.
Elizabeth tweets, please, please, please ask about this. The contact tracing seems super light on details. How many contact tracers have you hired, and how long is this process going to take?
Yes, so we have a team that's responsible for contact tracing at each school. We also collaborate with the contact tracing team at DC Health. And we've done a great job with being responsive to any need for contact tracing, as we've done over the summer and last school year. And we notify individuals as soon as possible if there's a need for quarantining or if there's some other response that needs to take place. And then it's also an element of our transparency of how we communicate to families when there's a positive case in their school or within a classroom.
The D.C. Council has been moving to take school resource police officers out of the D.C. public schools. I'm not quite sure exactly where that is, but does the district still have school resource officers inside the high schools and junior middle schools?
And yes,
are they
playing
any role?
Yeah, let me clarify. That's a great question. So there's school resource officers, and then there's the DCPS law enforcement team, and then there's security staff. We have the same structure for security staff we had in the past, and they are actively involved in our weapons abatement in the morning. They also are part of our supervision throughout the day. And then we also have our DCPS law enforcement team that supports them. We are currently now managing our security contract. Previously, that contract was managed by the Metropolitan Police Department. That's our structure going into the school.
The reason I ask is not because of students acting out, but I want to ask you, just like people on airplanes acting fools, are you having problems with parents being abusive to the school employees? Or, I know we're just starting, but is that an issue?
That has not been an issue for us. We also are limiting visitors in our buildings, so parents and guardians will not have the same access in the building that they've had.
I've gotten
prior
some pretty mean tweets and other things. I know people serving in public service have gotten some pretty mean, aggressive comments. I assume you've gotten some.
You know, I think we always hear from, you know, our critics, which we welcome. But the vast majority of our families have been supportive, as you noted earlier, a very complimentary of our teachers and our school staff.
Tom mentioned this earlier, and we're almost out of time, but I'm just going to mention it. Evan Yates, a commissioner for ANC 4B1, tweets, D.C. public schools has been promising upgraded and repaired HVAC systems since at least October 2020. Why then are there still a dozen schools with significant HVAC problems in the last week? Is that something you're looking at? We only have about 30 seconds left.
It is. I want to be clear. Our HVAC enhancements for COVID are different from regular maintenance. We do have regular maintenance that we're collaborating with Department of General Services on. We have a plan to ensure if there's a unit that's not functioning, that we have a temporary solution for start of school.
Chancellor Ferbey, thank you very much for joining us.
Best wishes for the school year.
Thank you.
And Andrea wanted to thank Tom and yours truly for doing the show, and thank Chief Chancellor Ferbey for doing a good job. Thanks, Andrea, but unnecessary. That's what we have to do. The Politics Hour is produced by Sidney Grannan, and our managing producers, Engelisa Schroffdorf. Our engineers today, Cliff Gallagher and Mike Kidd. And the man who keeps this show on the road is our phone screener, Bruce Romer. Thank you all for listening, and have a great weekend. I'm Kojo Nandi.